Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is Best Practice. And today you'll hear about something Robbie Williams has in spades, charisma.
Me with the floor show, kicking with your torso. Boys getting high and the girls even more so. Wave your hands if you're not with a man. Can I kick it?
Yes, you can!
It's something that might be very valuable to have at work, and we will get to it later. Let's start at the less flashy end of the scale with, well, resilience and coping skills. You might be someone who has these, and certainly you'll know someone who does. That person always seems to bounce back when things go base over apex, and they're relatively positive and optimistic when the outlook is frankly grim. What they have is something called psychological capital, and apparently you can have it too. Professor Yvonne Brunetto, who's at Southern Cross University, explains.
Well, psychological capital is a new concept which has been invented by Fred Luthen. It comprises four factors: self-efficacy, which is about a person's confidence to do a job; optimism, which is how they see the world, whether it's positively or negatively; hope, which means how hard they're prepared to work to achieve a specific goal; and resilience, the ability to bounce back.
All right, so those four dimensions, how useful is that altogether to a company?
Well, this is the brilliant thing. I have done research on nurses, doctors, engineers, local government employees, soldiers, social workers in Australia, the USA, Italy, UK. And each time I always have looked at organisational factors, because that's what the previous research had said, that if I examined organisational factors, it could increase the engagement and well-being of employees. Imagine my shock a few years ago at Academy of Management when this new variable is talked about, psychological capital. But it was by a very distinguished professor and I thought I'd examine it, particularly because my aim is to assist employers or organisations to increase their bottom line. So that's what I wanted to do. So I did. I tested this and the outcome was outstanding. Not only does PsychCap predict greater engagement and well-being, it is more predictive than organisational factors, management in particular.
You've looked in some particularly stressful environments. I think you mentioned nurses. I think you mentioned the police. These are occupations that are renowned for their kind of high workplace loading in terms of stress.
Try also soldiers and the personal carers that take care of dementia patients every day, that have to listen to their patients maybe getting very angry with them, but not really being angry, covering fear. And they have to deal with that day in and day out.
Yeah, all right, okay, I'm convinced. Now, but the thing I'm thinking, and I reckon a lot of people would be thinking this, isn't this fundamentally about character?
No, it's not.
Isn't it? Because, I mean, surely some people just have this stuff or have more of it.
We believed that previously that you're either born with psychological capital. Another word might be inner strength. Yes, character could have been a name for it in the past. However, the difference today is that we can upskill, we can train employees, we can give them the skills so that they can build psychological capital.
So some people might have more of it. Of course they do. We all know people who are more stoic or more curious or more, you know, positive. But you're saying that anyone can be taught to have more of it.
Yes, and that's the gift that I think Fred Luthen has given to organisations. Certainly the organisations he's examined in the US have seen a real increase in their bottom line, you know, dollar figures.
All right. Well, how do you do this? How do you teach people to have greater resilience or more optimism?
Well, there is a training program which Fred Luthen developed, and he very kindly offered his papers to me, and I was able to develop a similar program for Australia. And I have been delivering this program for the Brisbane Wesley Mission employees. So they have personal carers, they have nurses, they have social workers and management employees that are dealing with quite difficult clients at times, and my aim has been to increase their optimism, their hope, and their resilience. And the way I do it is to first of all begin by giving them knowledge, helping them understand the patterns that they develop 0 to 5, because without any intervention, that's what we repeat over and over again.
Yeah, you do. I imagine, though, that actually that first step in the process might be quite confronting, because it could feel like that you're saying, well, hang on, when you do that, it's natural, but it's kind of wrong. So that might be quite confronting for people.
Well, people have a natural response to something pretty awful happening. It's either flight or fright. If people don't like the response they've got, they immediately build quite a bit of stress. That might mean they're going home every afternoon and having to have a drink, or they're being quite angry with other people, when really what they're feeling is just bad about what's happened. That's where a new way of dealing with that stress, by looking at a previous pattern and in fact embedding a new pathway, setting new goals about behavior and a pathway to achieve the new ways of acting, that's what I focus on.
Can you give me an example of someone you've actually been able to help? Obviously, we don't want their name, but if you could just sort of talk me through it.
Yes, I can tell you about a nurse who spoke to me about a dementia patient who was screaming at her. It wasn't the first time. And her immediate reaction is, she has two conflicting goals. One is she's got to be nice to the client, right? Nice to the patient. But the other one is, this person's screaming at me. I want to scream back. I'm angry. So what I asked her to do is to look at her patterns. And then I asked her if that had served her well. And then we talked about, do you think this dementia patient was really angry? The answer was no. And so then we examined, was this dementia patient really scared about something? And yes, that was the situation. The minute she realized that the anger was simply covering fear about the next step for this patient, she was able to change her feelings about it. And then I gave her language to deal with. And this language was about replacing what she used to say with what we call an active and constructive response that acknowledged her anger, but also examined the fear behind the anger.
And that works.
Yeah, that works. But more importantly, that nurse went home at the end of the day not feeling stressed.
Do you know what I find most interesting about that, Yvonne, is that what you were saying before is, you know, we've learnt these responses to things. They go back to when we were children. We've been doing the same thing since we were 5. You're not quite saying, I don't think, all you have to do is point out there is another way and here it is, because there's still that habit in there, isn't there?
You have to be unhappy with the way you're responding now. You have to have figured out that it's not good for your body and not good for your mind. You have to be fairly determined to put a new goal about how you behave, and then all I'm doing is providing a pathway, a way of doing it. So I can't embed the idea that your original responses are inappropriate. You have to make that decision. That comes from knowledge.
Right. So it's really easy to see, given that example, how effective that can be. I suppose most of us are not dealing with those levels of stress. So for people in a more ordinary company environment, how can this approach help them?
I would have to differ in that perspective. Do you know how many organisations at the moment are putting their employees through change programs? Quite a few. It's change is not something that happens to just some firms. It's the majority. That means that employees are dealing with the employer expecting them to change what they're doing. There's probably a change in the power basis going on. So they're pretty scared, and they've got their 0 to 5 patterns in full born there, helping them to cope with what they see as a flight or fright situation.
So if we use this approach, we can give people greater psychological capacity, and in particular things like resilience and optimism, and I suppose they cope better with change, and ultimately, what, are they more productive?
Yes, the findings are outstanding. And I found them hard to believe, to be honest, because I'm a stats person first and foremost. And so by doing pre and post, we're able to see that they do increase the well-being of the employee. And the minute you improve well-being, the engagement of the employee increases because they can channel their energy into the vigor required to be engaged in the job.
And so can you actually say, well, look, here's the effect on the bottom line?
What I call the bottom line is reduced number of days off sick. Well-being days, I think they're called.
Mental
yes.
health days.
Yes,
is what
mental.
I've heard them called.
Yes. Well, if you're not feeling mentally stressed, there's no need for those. But what I also found is that it reduces turnover intention. So the way it helps an organisation is in three ways: reduced days off, reduction in turnover intentions. But the big one is reduced workers' compensation claims
for
stress-related issues.
So what could be possible down the track, taking this research and practice further?
I would imagine that any organisation could do well in the orientation program to include psychological capital training to help give their employees resources to cope with everyday stress.
Yvonne, it's been really fascinating to talk to you today. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Yvonne Brunetto is Professor of Human Resources Management at Southern Cross University's Business School. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. This is Best Practice on RN. I'm Richard Adie. You also heard from Chumbawamba. Now to charisma. I don't think most of us have this, and I think only a very few have a lot. They tend to be politicians or entertainers. Think Obama, Keating, Elvis, Helen Mirren or Kate Blanchett. Think Ronald Reagan, the entertainer who became a politician. I'm not sure about Trump, but plenty of people think he has bucket loads of it. So let's leave that there. What's clear is that it's very advantageous to have, including at work. And there's now interest in whether it can be taught. Here's science writer Matthew Hudson.
So charisma is this kind of mysterious attribute that people have been trying to understand and define for a long time. But the best definition I've come across was provided by a couple of evolutionary psychologists in a recent paper. They defined it as the ability to signal that you can create coordination or cooperation in a group of people. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you can create that cooperation. It just means that you signal that you can.
Right. So, in fact, it might be a trick, although if there's an evolutionary basis to it, normally there isn't too much false advertising in evolution. What do you reckon?
That's true. There are certain signals that people send that are hard to fake. Charisma might be one of them, or it might be costly to fake. So if you present certain signals that you will be a good leader and then turns out that people trust you and you don't serve them very well, then there's a great punishment for that. You could be ostracized or harmed or killed throughout evolutionary history.
I am going to resist temptation throughout this interview, Matthew, to talk about your presidential race. okay, so how can we, this seems like an obvious question, but how can you tell if someone has it? How do they display?
Well, there's some research showing that you can actually train people in certain tactics that present charisma. And some of those things that people who are charismatic do is they use metaphors a lot when they speak, and they use stories and anecdotes. They also express strong conviction, strong moral conviction and principles. They also set high expectations for themselves and for those they lead. And they express strong confidence that those expectations can be met. And then there are also lots of nonverbal signals. Their gestures, their facial expressions, and then just using an animated voice. So when people use any or all of these cues, they tend to be seen as charismatic.
So I'm intrigued by where you started that answer, which is there's some research that suggests you can train people, because
I'd have thought that it's almost by definition not something you can teach. You've either got it or you haven't.
That's right. There are certain genetic correlates, certain physical features. For instance, height is correlated with judgments of being charismatic, and personality, which is partially genetic. But there is some leeway for training. And in these experiments, people had dozens of hours of training, and that led to measurable differences in how they are perceived. But it's possible that even with just a few minutes of practice or being told that these are certain cues that you should use, that could lead to a difference in how you're perceived.
And what are those cues? Is it about using metaphors, telling stories, trying to be funny, having conviction? Is that it?
That's right. So they delineated about a dozen tactics, and they trained subjects in all of these tactics. They were either executives or they were MBA students. People practiced giving speeches, and they got feedback, and they went home and did homework, writing action plans on how they thought they could become more charismatic using these tools. And that's what led to the results.
All right. So it's been measured. What is the effect?
Well, there are obvious effects in personality and in popularity. People listen to you more. People respect you more. You're more successful on the dating market. You become a better leader at work. So in general, it's people tend to follow you. People tend to give you more respect and prestige, and you have more influence as a result of using these tools and coming off as charismatic.
So we can see that at work there'd be value in it. In fact, I think I read in a piece you've written that employees prefer the kind of insight and vision guy over the loyalty and long hours guy.
That's right. There was one study in which people were asked to judge one of two different executives. One was said to be successful through hard work and dedication and long hours, which is something that, you know, you could see yourself doing. It seems like an achievable way to become successful. And the other executive was described as being struck by inspiration. And so his success was kind of mysterious. You don't really know how he did what he did. And they asked people who was more charismatic and which one would you rather have as a leader. And they tended to choose the one who obtained success through inspiration or through some sort of mysterious methods.
Right. So there's a kind of attractiveness about the idea that this is lightning in a bottle, in a way.
It's almost a bit of magical thinking. In that study, they also asked people, whom would you rather touch? Whom would you rather receive a hug from? And then whose lucky charm would you rather hold on to? And of course, they chose to hug the charismatic leader who had a mysteriousness about him, or to hold on to the lucky charm of that leader.
And another thing, and I was really intrigued, was research that you've quoted, which says that essentially charisma is afforded more importance when it is not clear how well the company is doing, in a way.
That's right. So in one study, they asked people to pretend that they were on a company board and decide whether to keep or boot a CEO. And when the CEO's track record was clear, based on the performance of the company, based on the stock, they tended to use that company performance to influence their decision of whether to keep or boot the CEO. But when they didn't have that information, when the stock price just sort of was flat or they didn't really know what was going on with the company, that's when they tended to rely more on information about how charismatic the leader was.
That is really interesting, isn't it? Because there is no question at the moment that people are talking more and more about data, about analytics, about things that we can measure. Former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, said, you know, in God we trust, everybody else bring data. So that is kind of the opposite, isn't it?
Well, there's sort of a give and take. We like data, we like hard evidence, we like results, but that's not the only source of our judgments of people. There's also these indefinable qualities, these X factors. Some of it can be called charisma, and that can to some degree be measured, but even these definitions of charisma leave something out. Yeah. Humans are complex, and there's a lot of mystery there.
There is a paradox here, Matthew, because as you've just said, it's sort of indefinable, but you also quote the research where people are trying to break down what it is and in turn teach people to have the components, at least, of what make it up.
That's right. So part of the agenda of the field of psychology is to try to understand people and how they behave and how they think and how they interact. And so it's sort of very tantalizing to try to understand this idea of charisma. And I think progress has been made. But as with any human trait or behavior, you can't summarize it with just a single number, a single word, or a single list of points. So there will always be questions out there about people.
I'm wondering how far the research and especially the idea of teaching it can take us, because I suppose maybe half a dozen times in my life I've been aware of somebody who, when they walk into the room, everybody knows they're there. They have something that you can kind of feel, you can't explain.
That's right, and it's possible that a lot of that can't be taught. So I think this research on charisma, it's not going to give you a complete makeover as a person, and you probably wouldn't want that because there's something to be said for authenticity and each person being a unique individual, and some people are more charismatic and some people are not. But there is room for change in how you act.
One thing I'm not sure of, and I'm not sure what you think about this, is should we trust it? Should we trust charisma, or should we trust the things that can be taught about charisma?
That's a good question. So back to the definition that those two evolutionary psychologists came up with for charisma is that it's not the actual ability to lead people or to create cooperation in a group. It's the perceived ability. So someone can be very charismatic and give all these signals that they will be a good leader and get people to come together and achieve great things. But when you put them in a position of power, they might abuse it or they might just be completely incompetent. So you can't fully trust these signals. They're just sort of heuristic or rules of thumb that we might use.
I think now for about 30 years, we've had the cult of the chief executive, the idea that these guys, and they are mostly overwhelmingly men, make all the difference at the top of a company and they're paid accordingly. But it often turns out that, you know, they can't make the difference, or that a successful company is mostly about, you know, having a really good team in place and executing a strategy rather than, you know, some kind of charismatic vision. And yet we still find it a compelling idea.
That's right. I think we're biased to place a lot of emphasis on a CEO or a leader. It might just be our desire for simple explanations. We see correlations. We say, oh, there's a new CEO and this company is performing differently. CEO must be responsible. Or it could be a holdover from earlier evolutionary days when groups were smaller and a leader could make a big difference in how a group performed. Whereas now, if you have a multinational company in a complex economic environment with thousands of employees, one CEO might not make a huge difference. And still, we look to that CEO for leadership and praise or blame that CEO for the outcome of the company.
Matthew, you've identified this research and told us the story of essentially people being taught at least some of the elements or components of having charisma. Do you think this is going to be a thing, more of something that in management business schools and management programs, people are taught to try to have charisma?
I think this has been a thing for a long time. There have been coaches and trainers for years, for executives, for politicians. It's probably been on the upswing, especially since the age of television, where now there's a huge industry for people to perform well on TV or in front of large groups of people. But I think this is something that people have paid for and people have tried to improve on for a long time.
It sounds like, though, there is more of an effort to understand the psychology behind it and perhaps to tweak it and model it more closely.
I don't know if there is more of an effort now. I think there might just be more progress in what we have learned. It's something that people have talked about and studied for decades. But as with any scientific field, you make progress in baby steps. And we note the most recent discoveries and say, oh, we're onto something now. This is really a big study. Whereas it's something that people have really thought about for a long time.
Matthew Hutson. And that's it for this week. You can find out more on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. The program's produced by Georgia Power. Our sound engineer is Amory de Bettencourt. I'm Richard Adie. I don't want to rock, dear.